and welcome to Here in L.A., Chesterfield Square Edition. Cue the Renaissance flutes, because today we talk with Lex Stepling. Lex is a native Angeleno who's lived all over L.A., from the beach to Pasadena and even South Central, which is what we're going to talk about today. He's a father, seemingly a bookworm, a music lover, and a sports fan. Today we'll talk about growing up in Chesterfield Square in South L.A., gentrification, seeing Nirvana at the Forum, and the sadness about how families can no longer take in a baseball game at Dodger Stadium. Speaking of families, he'll also talk about raising kids in L.A. Is it possible? Can I do it? Lex will tell us. So here he is, Lex Stepling. Hey, everybody. I am here in Hollywood. But we're going to be talking about Chesterfield Square, which I bet you is a neighborhood you don't even know where it is on a map. And I'm here with Lex Stripping?
Stepling.
Stepling! Hey! Okay, so Lex and I have been talking for about an hour and a half without the mics, which is heartbreaking because it was a very good conversation.
It was.
And Obama, if you've spied on us, then he's having a good time right now.
Yeah, we gave him a lot of good stuff.
Lex, from our talk, I've learned that you've lived all around L.A.
That's right.
But I want to focus on your time in South L.A., very close to Inglewood.
Which
the L.A. Times map calls Chesterfield Square.
You can hear the Renaissance flutes as you say that.
When you lived there, was there any Renaissance music going on?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Every morning you'd hear the bells of the jester coming by your window and, you know, the brass trumpets when the king was coming through the court.
What, were you in high school when you were there?
I would have been, but I didn't, I stopped going to high school very young.
Were your parents okay with you bopping out like that?
Yeah, I mean, my mother had done the same thing. My mother was a teen mom. Mm. She understood. She also needed help. I needed to be working. I needed to be helping the family. Had another parent that was incarcerated at the time. So I also, you know,
I did have to work.
I guess that's the short version of the story.
Were you the oldest kid?
Yes.
Aha. So where'd you work?
So it's interesting because my first job, I was very lucky. So this time in Los Angeles, and this is actually really good kind of political history too about what works and what doesn't work. Because during this time in LA, this was still at the kind of the peak of what people were calling the HIV/AIDS crisis.
So is this late 80s, early 90s?
No, this is mid-90s.
Mid-90s, okay.
Mid-90s into the late 90s.
Okay.
I guess it's late 90s. It was a long peak, we forget. As a result of that crisis, public health resources kind of trickled down into communities. So, you know, you had the LA Free Clinic and you had Children's Hospital Division of Adolescent Medicine, which is right here by where you record your podcast. And there was a lot of dynamic youth programs and a lot of really great public health programs, and there was a transgender led clinic out of Children's Hospital that was amazing. There was just a lot of really great programming. Mm-hmm. And so I got my first job at the LA Free Clinic. They had a peer education program called Project ABLE, and they hired youth from the community to work with youth from the community. So that kind of got me my first work and my first job. And it was a minimum wage job. And at that time in Los Angeles, with a minimum wage job, I was able to rent my own apartment in Echo Park.
How about that? Okay, minimum wage back then was like $6?
$6.25.
See, this is why the middle class is screwed right now. Because we hear about previous generations of a public school teacher marrying a short order cook at like Tommy's Burger. And they could buy a house.
It's really interesting because, you know, I'm of the first generation where they decided to make it really hard to even buy a house. But it wasn't hard to rent an apartment if you had a job. Mm-hmm. And let me not say it wasn't hard. Everything's hard. I never want to take away from all of our struggles or whatever. But what's interesting is now to rent an apartment, not even a nice one, in Los Angeles, is one of the most difficult things a person can do, one of the most humiliating things a person can go through, and one of the most expensive things a person can do. And that has created this whole new identity where I hear politicians say it. I hear people say it. I'm a renter.
Mm-hmm.
And what is mind-blowing, what neither you nor me nor anyone else could have anticipated, would have been that being a renter would be a place of privilege.
Right.
So if I'm 16 years old on my own with a minimum wage job and I'm renting an apartment in Echo Park, that sounds wild.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds unbelievable. At that time, you know, I'd been living in lots of different parts of LA. I'd lived in downtown, had lived in Echo Park. These were areas that people didn't necessarily want. Lots of people were perfectly fine to be there, but these areas had bad reputations.
They were not desirable.
They were not seen as status neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And Echo Park had a reputation for being really violent. Mm-hmm. And every place with a reputation for being violent, half that reputation is undeserved, and then the other half is complicated. Mm. In any case, I didn't finish high school.
Which surprises me, Lex, because we've only known each other now for a couple hours. Incredibly intelligent man. What do you base this on? Do you read a lot of books?
Sometimes. I go through stretches of reading a lot, but I like to do light reading. I just finished a book called Swing Kings about the revolution/evolution of the baseball swing. Have you heard of this book?
No.
So do you remember when Justin Turner all of a sudden became good?
Yes.
And everyone was like, how did this like Punch and Judy utility infielder become an all-star?
Yeah.
And he credited it with these swing coaches in Santa Clarita. Or no, these guys were out in like Chatsworth or something, somewhere in the valley. These two dudes had started, like, maybe it was Santa Clarita. They had started like a swing lab. And it documents the whole story about going all the way back to Ted Williams writing a book about hitting in the 40s or 50s when he said you're supposed to elevate the ball. But then conventional wisdom in baseball, when you played Little League, when I played Little League, they always said swing down on the ball.
Yeah.
And then what was his name? Charlie Lau became the famous hitting coach. Swing down on the ball.
For the Yankees, right?
The A's
first. I think Billy Martin used him a lot as his
Billy Martin used him. He did it for the Royals. I think he did it for the A's, maybe for the Yankees. He mm-hmm. was the famous hit guru.
He was the guy.
George Brett said he's the dude who made me who I am. I think Don Mattingly, all these like famous disciples. Uh-huh. And there was this dude in Southern California, Craig Wallenbeck.
Okay.
I think he was even from Pasadena. And he had been a baseball player, I think, in college, and apparently pretty good, but like dropped out, and then I think had tried to avoid the draft and become a surfer, and whole interesting story. I don't want to misquote what his story is, but then his brother decided to become a baseball player again, and he got back into trying to help his brother hit. Mm. And he was one of the first dudes who started recording. So he had in the early days of having a video camera of a camcorder, he would record the swing.
So like a Rodney King type video
camera. Maybe even pre. Why don't we know that guy's name?
Who shot the video?
Yeah, he should be a household name.
You're barely 40, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I used to know that guy's name because that was like the first viral video ever.
It was. And I remember that time.
And we should know his name. You're right.
I was in fourth grade when that happened.
Did all your fourth grader kids, did you guys all watch it on KTLA that night? Did you talk about it in school that next day?
Everything went off. I mean, people forget how quickly everything escalated.
Mm-hmm.
So
in fourth grade, were you downtown?
No, I was part-time in Pasadena
okay. And
part-time in Venice. And blocks burned in both areas.
They did?
Yeah.
Pasadena burned?
Not all of it, but certain blocks burned. The arcade...
It burned after the cops got away with it, right?
Right. After the verdict, when things escalated, you know, we lived in Oakwood, Venice.
Yes.
That burned. There was a National Guard on every corner.
Wow.
And then also lived in Pasadena, which...
I didn't know that Pasadena burned.
You know, Pasadena has a really complex, interesting history around this stuff. Rodney King was from Altadena.
That's right, because he was driving that freeway. He got beat up in
The 210, right?
Yeah.
He was from Altadena.
Wow. Which is very diverse. A lot of black folks live.
Yeah, he was from West Altadena. That's a historically very black community. Mm-hmm. Pasadena is a historically very black town.
Absolutely. Jackie Robinson.
Jackie Robinson, Michael Zinzin, many people. You know, yeah. We talk about George Jackson and Jonathan Jackson and the really profound political history of them. They were from Pasadena. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of really important black history in Pasadena.
Absolutely.
Including Jackie Robinson, which is so important. And yet there's not a single school there named after Jackie Robinson, which feels really mad. But
there's that park, but not a school.
He went to John Muir High School.
And they can't change John Muir's name?
You would think that if Jackie Robinson went to your high school, you'd think it would be named Jackie Robinson High School.
But isn't John Muir kind of problematic right now?
I'm sure he was a naturalist. He was probably a eugenicist too, but I don't know. I'm just joking. I don't know.
I don't want to cancel everybody, but you're absolutely right. Jackie Robinson should.
There's plenty of things named after John Muir.
There is.
Jackie Robinson's. He went to the school. You would think, you know, you would think that if that's the school he went to, they would.
And his brother.
I don't know where John Muir went to high school, but my guess is they would name it after him, wherever that was. Yeah, Mack Robinson, who came in second to Jesse Owens in the Munich Olympics, Hitler Olympics.
Really, you know your sports.
They did name a post office after Mack Robinson on Lincoln.
Okay.
So Rodney King was from Altadena. Mm-hmm. When he got his settlement from LAPD, he started a rap label called Altapaz Records, Altadena Pasadena.
How about that?
And he funded a lot of the local rappers in that community.
See, people, this is why I do this podcast. Because when you talk to people, even people you don't know, after 15 minutes, the knowledge just comes oozing out. Isn't this why you love people, Lex?
Yeah, and I appreciate that, you know, LA especially now. When I was growing up, our city, and we haven't even once talked about Chesterfield Square yet, but cue the Renaissance flute. But when I was growing up, LA was not a city that thought about itself very much. Maybe because it's so big, we weren't a city that talked about ourselves. We weren't a city that probably even thought about ourselves. And again, I think it's because it's so big. I think it's a universe unto itself, but I also think because it's constantly being looked at from the outside and filmed, etc. So I grew up and there would be people who weren't from here telling me what LA was compared to where they were from. So I would just hear things about how spread out it is, how fake it is, how stupid everybody here is and shallow. How we don't have any good bakeries and we don't have any good delis. Those are the things that I would hear. None of it made... Oh, and also, of course, how dangerous it was.
Right.
But none of that made sense to me. I didn't understand. I was like, how can you guys talk about a place like it's the most dangerous, rough town, and then it's also the most superficial bourgeois town? You say this at the same time. And then meanwhile, everything we produce gets consumed really quickly, culturally. So I would hear people say LA was a place without culture, but then I would see the culture that came out of LA changing, being responded to by the world constantly. And so I didn't think it was LA culture. I was like, oh, I guess that's just culture. That's just stuff. Like the music that came out of here, the fashion that came out of here, the style, the car culture, all the things I thought must exist everywhere. This is the truth. This is what I thought growing up. I was like, well, I guess it exists everywhere. And then when like in the 90s, when hip hop's regional culture got really broadcast, then people started being interested in like, oh, in New York, they dress like this and they talk like this. And in the South, the rappers dress like this and they talk like this. And in LA, they do this way. And then in the Bay Area, they do that way. So then everybody, I think, started reflecting a little bit on it. But it wasn't until gentrification hit us that my generation, anyway, started to have to really reflect on what our culture was and what it meant to be from here and what is LA and what isn't. And also, I lived in New York for about a decade on and off for work and stuff. And when I got there, everybody was like, you have an LA accent and you dress LA and you talk LA. And I had never heard of that. I was like, we don't have an accent. We don't. You have an accent. You know what I mean?
Forget about it.
Yeah. And right. A bunch of Bronx Tales sounding motherfuckers telling me I have an accent. No, I'm just kidding. I was like, oh, interesting. And now, right, 2024, this stuff gets just talked about very normally. There is an LA accent. There is an LA this. There is an LA that. And the city's talked about in that way that other cities are talked about. But that's newer and interesting and also creates a little bit of panic because I have a lot of family in the Bay Area. Grew up going there to visit them. They got hit with gentrification before we did. I lived in New York. I saw how it happened there. And so it made me scared because I'm like, once they start identifying through a set of signifiers, the accent, the way of dress, the this, the that, what they're really doing is making a museum exhibit out of you because it might be about to be over.
So you watched Echo Park go from not desirable to highly desirable.
I did. And you know, there was two things. This is, I guess, why you like this shit. It's super specific for me. Mm-hmm. I saw two things happen and I was barely beginning to get an understanding of what gentrification looked like. Because the city council person at the time, Javier Baceta was on his way out. Garcetti was on his way in for city council. Mm-hmm. Eric Garcetti, right? Because his dad was still DA.
Right. Losing to OJ.
That's right. And then Steve Cooley, who for some reason is in the news a lot lately, came in. And Steve Cooley came in as a reform DA because he was against three strikes. But now he's in the news talking like an arch reactionary. It's all very strange. So Echo Park, yeah. So I'd lived there as a small child. And then I lived there again in my early teens. And the intersection of Glendale Boulevard and Scott.
Where the McDonald's is?
The McDonald's is, I believe, off of Montana. Where Scott intersects with Glendale, it's like where it comes down the hill. And there used to be a little Mexican restaurant there, but now it's like a cannabis place.
Don't know anything about that, sir.
Okay. So there used to not be a light there.
Oh, really?
And so it was a really dangerous intersection.
I bet.
And it was a terrible place to make a left turn.
Yeah.
And then one day there was a light. And around that same time, Masa of Echo Park opened.
Hold on. Don't talk. You know where I'm from.
There's a Chicago thing.
Are you about to talk trash about my pizza place?
No.
Thank you.
No, but
I got defensive all of a sudden.
Well, that's good to know, but I'll explain in a second why it's good to know.
Okay.
So when I saw that shit pop up.
A Chicago pizza place?
It didn't say that it was Chicago.
It says bakery.
It just says Masa of Echo Park. That doesn't sound Chicago to me.
No, it doesn't.
But when we started seeing places named after nouns, we knew shit was like...
Masa was the red flag.
One of the four horsemen of gentrification.
Was Masa.
No, it's restaurants named after a single noun. If the place is called Oat or Spoon.
I mean, you're right, though. It doesn't belong there.
I'm just saying it's funny now because that place is seen as like a stalwart of the community. Back then, I saw it and I immediately held a grudge. And I was like, I'm never setting foot in... But let me finish, okay? Because I said, I'm never setting foot in that place again. Not again. I'm never setting foot in that place, period. Because these two things happen. Now you get a fucking stoplight and now there's the bakery. And I know what this means. And sure enough, Echo Park, you know.
What does it mean?
It meant that it was being gentrified.
White folks are coming.
Well, and let me say this too. There have always been white people in Echo Park.
Okay.
Echo Park's always had diversity that it doesn't get credit for.
Yes.
As just like Silver Lake. Silver Lake and Echo Park were both really special places. They were very diverse.
They were special.
Past tense.
Damn.
They were special points of energy. They were politically activated. Mm-hmm. They were very like everybody was welcome. They were very queer communities. They were very class diverse communities. They were very political communities. And I don't mean political in the inside game bullshit. I mean like people with radical politics lived there, thrived there. They were artists of every generation. And it was very special and very LA. Like prior to you recording, we were saying there was a time, especially in LA, where being an artist was not a synonym for being privileged. Arts didn't come from the gentry. And I'm talking theater, I'm talking music, all came from the hood.
Yeah.
And Echo Park was one of those places, as was Venice, as were many places. So Masa opened up and the aesthetic, and also Masa of Echo Park, that doesn't sound, that sounded away to me. So let me just finish, because you got defensive, that I did finally go there recently. I finally let go of my, my wife was like, their food's good. She's from the neighborhood too. She's like, she's like, let it go.
Yeah.
I was like, fine. So I went in and I ate there. And I mentioned to the guy.
What did you have?
We had, we didn't have the deep dish because we didn't have time.
It does take a while.
But I don't even remember what we had. But it was good. It was really good.
Good.
But the waiter, he was talking, and I said, you know, I have to tell you, this is a big deal for me. You guys opened in, what, 97 or something. I vowed to never set foot in this place because you're on some gentrifier bullshit. And he was like, oh, no, we're really down for the community. The Blue Bottle Coffee just tried, he had an Australian accent. And he's like, Blue Bottle Coffee just tried to open up, and we told him to go fuck themselves. Like, we're all about the neighborhood. And it hit me. I was like, to most people, this is like the OG Echo Park spot. That's all. So the light on Scott, Masa of Echo Park, and then a lot of places held out for a long time, though, because you have places where the gentrification happened really fast, radically fast. Highland Park, never seen anything flip that fast.
What's your astrological sign, Lex?
I'm a Taurus.
I have a feeling we could talk all damn day. I feel like we have a lot in common. The reason that, that I reached out to you is we were talking about Nirvana playing at the Forum.
That's right.
In 94.
That's right.
And you see, I'm a giant Kurt Cobain fan.
And we were both there. You were there?
We were both there.
I was there too.
You were how old?
Maybe 11.
11 years old.
Yeah.
And you knew of Nirvana? Did you know any of their songs?
Absolutely. They were huge.
Really? And so who, do you remember who took you to this concert?
A friend of mine's brother, my friend's older brother. I'm not going to say who because he's a known person. And
Tupac?
Tupac? but I don't know how he's doing these days. So I'm going to leave his name out of the ether. But he had the hookup.
And you're not religious. So we can't even say a prayer for him right now?
We can say a prayer for him. Okay. I'm not. I am spiritual.
Okay.
Whatever that means. As far as religion is concerned, my feeling is that the cosmos and the vastness of time, space, they, I'm perfectly fine with someone calling that God, right? Because I feel like the subtext of God is something we can't understand. We can't comprehend, something greater than us. So when I try to conceive of the universe, it's kind of nice because it's like putting my brain on a treadmill. Like trying to, it's like the, it forces you into a little momentary existential crisis. Like, what is this? Who are we?
Yes.
What is this? So when I try to conceive of the vastness of the universe, including now, like understanding that time isn't at all how we imagine it. And they say it's not linear. I don't even know what that means. When I try to imagine that, that feels kind of religious.
Okay.
So I'm down to say.
Have you done shrooms or anything like that?
Yeah, I've done shrooms.
That kind of makes me feel like what you're talking about. Like, damn, I really don't know anything.
Shrooms makes me feel very, less about the cosmos and more about the earth. It feels, I feel very earthly. Like,
I do too.
Very connected to the things in front of me.
And we love urban life. But when I am on shrooms out in the woods, I'm like, do I belong in, I think I belong in the woods.
Well, you end up feeling kind of guilty because you see how alive nature is. And you're like, well, are we a destructive force? It's kind of intense because.
Are we? Of course we are.
Right. And
we
so,
might be the worst force.
So it's right. But I just don't want to act like anything's as simple as I think it is all. But yes.
I'm not as smart as you, so I have to dumb things down.
I'm just saying that you really do talk to the trees.
You do?
Yeah. And so you're like,
you really
all
right. Hug the trees.
Yeah. I'm really into like, because you see, you're from Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
You're from a place with seasons.
Yeah.
I'm true. From here. So the grass is always greener on the other side as far as the aesthetic of a place. So mm-hmm. I'm very taken with like things that feel like they're straight out of Middle Earth. Mm. You know, the fantasy novel, the fantasy genre mm-hmm. aesthetic. Where I imagine water and greenery and, I mean, Chesterfield Square, you know, like it. So But
in LA, the seasons are more subtle. Like right now, we're both wearing jackets, kind of a thing. Like in a few months, we'll both be wearing shorts.
I disagree. I'm not going to wear shorts. But
you're not a shorts guy?
No, not a shorts guy.
Huh.
I disagree with people who say there's no seasons in LA. They don't understand the seasons.
That's
so,
what I'm saying.
So I agree with you. I don't mean to be shorthand because you're right. Because one of the big ways you experience the seasons in LA, which I love in Southern California, is the scents.
Yes.
Different flora and fauna blooming different ways. So you'll smell the geraniums or you'll smell, there's certain really specific smells you get when the seasons change here that you don't get in other parts of the country.
That's right.
So yes, LA has seasons. And yeah, especially lately, like that horrible biblical drought we had for 20 years was the most miserable, depressing thing. So now that we have our rainy season back, by the way, stop talking like it's so unprecedented. I grew up, we had a rainy season. Now that we have a rainy season again, I actually love the rain. I love weather because I grew up here. The sunny, monotonous thing, to me, I find it depressing. And I actually think that like the old noir films, like the Billy Wilder films, the noir, it's funny that it's called film noir because it was, to me, both born and inspired by Los Angeles because they knew that there was a darkness to it all. And this is like a city of so many broken dreams and ghosts and the sun happens to be out. And that is the noir. And there's something monotonous about it and something very unpleasant about it. And, you know, this is my city and it's in my blood and I can't connect, I can't separate myself from it as far as who I am. So I do love LA, but I don't believe LA is the most pleasant place. I believe it to be a very difficult place. And if we're saying, are we spiritual or not, whether what I mean is a metaphor or not, because I'm not sure, but it's a place of a lot of ghosts. You know, LA is very haunted. There's an evil here. And
I totally agree with you, but wouldn't you also agree that dreams do come true here?
Dreams come true everywhere.
Not where I'm from.
Whenever
maybe a girl had to move to LA for our dreams.
Whenever I see footage of Chicago after the 85 Bears, I would say that you're not correct.
We had one championship. We've 105-year-old
I used to love the Chicago super fans on SNL. Who would win in a fight? A hurricane or Mike Ditka?
Or Ditka. Okay. So there's three tanks and one Ditka. Who you got? Is it because I'm from somewhere else that I believe that dreams come true here?
Maybe I'm not understanding that perspective because I'm from here. But I will say, you know, Los Angeles attracts so much creative energy. And yes, the industry, but it attracted the industry too. Mm-hmm. You know, the SNA film company started in Chicago and came to LA.
Look at you.
And
you are a high school dropout and you're just spitting knowledge left and right. We could talk politics, music, now old Hollywood. And you get this knowledge from where?
Lots of places. You know, my great grandfather was an actor in the SNA film company. Like a character actor. Like,
wow.
Back when they would hire all these people to, the SNA film company would churn out 50 films and like it was like a factory.
Yeah.
And this wasn't like,
was this in Edendale that they were, have you heard about the Edendale?
That I don't know. I don't know.
World?
I don't know where.
It's where the two, almost where we're talking about before the freeways, that's where one of the first Hollywood studios were.
I'm always interested where stuff used to be here.
Me too.
I'm always really interested in that because LA doesn't preserve its architecture. So
it's so weird.
We don't get to know. Shit gets like steamrolled.
Yeah.
It's like, that's our real legacy here of how politics have worked. But to your point about, or to our point about SNH, so they would hire these actors who would play 3, 4, 5. These were silent films. This wasn't Lawrence of Arabia. This is like little silent Western films that have a bunch of different people playing a bunch of different roles. Multiple. It was like a working class. Hollywood had a working class. And there were stuntmen and there were wrestlers. And this was like a very colorful, the backlot culture, they called it. So he was a part of that. But it's always attracted and been a place. And one thing I'll say, as if we think about this idea of why here, because LA does tend to produce a lot of cutting edge culture. But a lot of places do, but certainly LA does. So when I'm in Chicago or I'm in New York or I'm in these other places, I feel like I much more feel like I'm a part of the world. The air feels like how the air feels everywhere else. When it gets humid, you feel viscerally a part of planet Earth. I feel connected to the rest of the world when I'm in those places in a way that I like. Whereas when I'm in LA, I feel like I'm in a different dimension. LA is ethereal. It's like a portal into another dimension or something, or some purgatory or some in between. I don't know, but it's this very ethereal place that it's its own dimension. The light's weird. The air's weird. And when you're here, you're here. And for better and for worse. And it might be why things come out here that are different. The Frankfurt School was here. A certain type of thinkers, a certain type of radicalism that's always been incubated here. Certain type of arts work that's always been incubated here that doesn't belong or fall in line. And, you know, we were talking about, like, you mentioned before we started recording about the history of rock. And, you know, Mike Davis wrote a lot about how LA was the capital of kind of both cults and the occult, right? The weird Crowleyite stuff that was being practiced over in the Arroyo in Pasadena, where JPL now is. And the man who started JPL was all into that. And they were always trying to summon demons and spirits, the occult, but also the cult. And a lot of psyops that happened here, right? There's that book about like the Laurel Canyon rock scene. That to me makes sense that would have been here. And there's that whole lineage like of just weird, tripped out shit, right, on all fronts.
Yeah.
It's not a coincidence to me that so often, like, New York's the mecca of hip hop and deserves to claim that. But why every generation is like the best rapper come out of LA? And I don't mean that in the competitive sense, but there's a cutting edge here that lives here.
Are you saying Kendrick's the best right now?
Yeah. I think I am saying that, but I don't really, that doesn't mean he's my favorite.
Right.
I just think that, like, you remember Ice Cube's peak?
Peak?
Do you remember that peak he had?
Like 90,
like from Death Certificate to not Death Certificate, from America's Most Wanted to Death Certificate. That's what I meant to say. And the Predator.
Early 90s.
Early 90s to...
Starting with No Vaseline.
From that to, like... Because I thought The Predator was such a classic album.
Me too.
But that stretch of him, you know, he was so good. He was transcendently good.
Without Dr. Dre.
Yep.
Go back to Nirvana though real quick.
Yeah.
You're 10 years old?
I was 10 or 11. My friend, older brother, had the hookup. And so we went. I don't remember who took us there, how we got there.
And your parents are okay with a 10-year-old Lex going to Inglewood?
I don't remember who took me. I don't, you know, my... Everybody went to the Forum back then. Everybody went to the Forum for everything. Yeah. Are you meaning because I was so little?
Yeah.
Because
I asked because I saw AC/DC's Back in Black tour when I was 14. And my mom dropped me off at the arena. And she still swears that she didn't. And I was like, well, who else would have? Because it wasn't close. Like, at least the Forum is relatively close to Chesterfield Square. But where I had to go, and she was like, do you know how young 14 is? And so I'm asking you now, Lex, do you know how young 10 is?
Well, my first concert was a year before that. It was Primus at the Hollywood Palladium. And I was really
known as Big Bad Beaver.
It was before that, though.
Okay.
It was the My Name Is Mud, that album.
Oh yeah.
I forgot what that album was called. Frizzle Fry.
Look at you.
Right?
Yeah.
And I had a couple older cousins. Primus was from the Bay Area. And I had a couple older cousins that were also from the Bay Area. And they really liked Primus. So they got me into them.
Yeah.
And I really liked them. And I was looking through the LA Weekly one day. And I saw in the back page ads, they would have like event ads. And yeah. So they had the ad for Primus at the Hollywood Palladium. Mm-hmm. And it was, so I cut out the ad. And
wait, though, 10 years old at the Palladium? Maybe 9?
Everybody told me. I was like, I'm going to go. And so I had an older cousin here in LA, and she's like, I'll take you.
Uh-huh.
She was probably 18 or something. Uh-huh. And I had a friend of mine, the same friend whose brother hooked us up with the Nirvana tickets later, actually, now that I think of it. Mm-hmm. And she said she would take me. So I had an older cousin there with me. She was...
But see, to me...
But everybody used to always say how rough the Palladium was, that it was such a rough place. But that place, I don't know how it is. I've not been there in forever.
Yeah.
So I have no... I don't even know if it even exists now.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But it was kind of a magical place.
It is a magical
place. It's like a high school gym.
It is exactly like a high school gym. In that it's a flat floor, like parquet type floor. And I mean, I guess there's the upper deck that the executives are at. But most of the people are just on the flat floor.
And it has the same acoustics of a high school gym, but in a good way.
Yeah.
And so the place really rocks.
But that's why I'm saying a 10-year-old would have a hard time because you're shorter than everybody.
Oh, yeah. No, I got pinballed the whole night, but I had so much fun. I had so much fun. And what's funny is that Butthole Surfers played there. So they played, if I remember correctly, they played there. And then they also opened for Nirvana a year later. So I think they played both times. Yeah. And there was some other weird band. And, you know, in the 90s, right, concert culture was a much different thing.
It was.
And I'm sure it was in the 80s and 70s, but I don't know. But it's not that now. So there was a certain special, exciting thing. And again, pre-internet, like, you didn't have access to much stuff. So to get to hear things, see things, get the t-shirt, like, it was a big... You can order online. And I have 4 teenage kids. I have 2 little kids. 4 of my kids are teenagers.
Wow.
So... My wife and I, we get them like cool band shirts.
Great.
You got to be cultured.
Yes.
But all I have to do is go online and buy it.
Right.
Back then, if you had a band shirt from a concert, that was such a, that meant something. It meant you had been there. It was a big deal, like the ultimate conversation.
And you
wore it
the next day. It's cool.
You sure did. And I got in trouble actually because I was in 5th grade. I think I wore the shirt the next day and maybe it had a marijuana leaf on it or something. I don't remember.
And the teachers got mad at you?
By then, remember, 90s is when they really started criminalizing youth in California. So this is when they started like telling you everything you had on was somehow, you know, contraband. Mm-hmm. So Nirvana at the Forum, and that's how we were talking on Twitter. Mm-hmm. We didn't have good seats, but yes, Nirvana was a really big deal. Again, LA at that time, everybody listened to everything.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a... Oh, we only listen to this kind of music and you only listen to everybody.
What was your radio station that you'd like to listen to?
Well, I listened to a lot of K-Rock back then.
Yep.
Because remember, Loveline was on at night.
Oh my God, the best.
You had Rodney on the Rock. You had...
You had Richard Blade at noon.
Uh-huh. Doug the Slug.
Yep.
Jed the Fish.
Jedem Fishem.
And Kevin and Kevin and Bean in the morning.
Right.
And so it was an event.
And they did play a lot of different types of music. We talked about Cypress Hill earlier. They would play Cypress. They'd play Snoop Dogg.
And see, where I lived, the communities I lived in was all... Everybody listened to everything. But I lived in communities that were definitely oriented toward hip-hop.
Yeah.
So hip-hop and rap music was what was being played in people's houses on the block. It was the standard.
Yeah.
So for me, I found at the time, the alternative rock scene, I found it really... exotic and interesting, and I think I was a bit of a contrarian. Like, I didn't want to be into what everybody else was into, so I liked rap a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to it, but I found what was happening with the alternative rock scene really interesting.
I mean, it was the peak back then.
It was. And as a kid, it really, I just thought it was so sophisticated and so sensitive and such thoughtful music. Mm-hmm. And gangster rap was really popular at the time.
Yeah.
So looking back, when I listen to a lot of that gangster rap now, and I really like it. It was great music.
Like, who are you talking about?
Like, I love old, like, Booyah Tribe and you know, of course,
nobody
like,
talks about the Booyah Tribe.
Underrated.
Were these, like, five Samoans from Long Beach? Is that who they
were? Carson.
Carson. Close enough.
They were Samoans from Carson.
And they were great.
Amazing. Amazing. They were musicians. They'd played in the church.
Yep. Booyah Tribe. Lex.
They went and got famous in Japan first.
I'm going to bail you out of jail just because of that.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Noted.
And they were powerful, and they were good rappers, and they had good songs. Like, they were...
Man, go back and listen to their early albums. Were so, so good.
Mm-hmm.
But also, yeah, all the Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And MC8, DJ Quick, everything.
Were you into the Beastie Boys at all?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what I mean to say is that I also didn't like it back then because the issues that they were rapping about, to be honest, were very real. That real stuff was happening. And I felt really like I didn't, at the time, all the violence that was happening in that era in Los Angeles was upsetting to me. Mm-hmm. I was a kid. I found it upsetting. Mm-hmm. I was around it. Family was very impacted by it. Mm-hmm. I felt a way about it. I felt kind of judgmental. Yeah. And so I think the music that was riffing on it and the way that music was being consumed made me a little bit uncomfortable at the time.
Right.
I look back now. Too
close to home.
Yeah, but maybe it was the way that it was being consumed. You know what I mean? There was something about it that I just felt, it felt ugly. There was a way that it felt mean-spirited, the way it was this transaction between consumer and what was being put out. And I'll have to think about it more. But I felt a certain judgmental thing towards it as a kid. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I listened to a lot of it now. It was great music. And more than ever, you know, we need to not project onto art the way we do. But when the alternative rock scene was happening, that felt like a really refreshing.
Yeah.
And like I said, it felt sophisticated. Like, I'm a kid, but you're like, you know... Again, art was everywhere. The other thing about LA back then, pre-gentrification, space wasn't such a commodity. So there was art happening all around.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand how lucky we were. There was free music everywhere. There was art everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to romanticize 80s and 90s LA because shit was fucked up too. Let's be really clear, right? The drug wars, the militarized policing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you could rent an apartment for cheaper. And yeah, there was art everywhere and community everywhere. And it birthed and incubated a lot of incredible organizing work. Mm-hmm. But it was also a very violent time.
Yeah.
A very craven time. We didn't have our own independent channels of communication like we do now with social media to broadcast what we knew to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So... you know, mainstream media was able to just demonize everybody, all the welfare queen shit, all the tough on crime bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was also just a very...
Were you given a D.A.R.E. t-shirt?
Of course.
Did you wear it?
No. I don't know. I remember getting them, and I remember the McGruff crime dog stickers. Mm-hmm. I remember all that. So anyway, just... I did love the so Nirvana was so great, obviously. They still are.
Even at 10, you got it at 10 years old.
Well, remember too, their music was catchy.
Yeah.
It's not like I was tripping on his lyrics at the time. I still...
They weren't the Butthole Surfers.
I also don't really listen to lyrics at first. Good. I'm actually really a philistine about music. I need that beat to shake my bones before I even care about what you're saying. So it's not like I was like, wow, this Kurt Cobain guy, he's a poet. At 10 years old, I didn't care what he was saying.
And he wasn't trying to be a poet.
I'm just saying whether he was or wasn't, that wasn't registering.
Yeah.
I just thought their music was catchy. It was heavy.
Yeah.
It was funky. Like, it was...
Yeah, Grohl on drums.
It kind of was hip-hop, you know?
A little bit.
And it was bassy.
Yep.
It sounded good in a car.
Sure did.
You know, because popular rock before them, it had, right, it was the end of the glam rock era.
Yeah.
And looking back, a lot of that stuff was actually pretty good too.
Hell yeah.
But the aesthetic of it for a kid, I thought they looked so goofy. They looked like clowns.
Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses?
The Motley Crue, Guns N' Roses, White
Twisted
Snake. Twisted Sister, White Snake. But then also the other shit like The Cure and Morrissey. Mm. All of that stuff felt like clownish to me.
Chesterfield Square. Did you guys ever call it Chesterfield Square?
No.
Did you know any guys named Chester?
I didn't, actually, fortunately.
What year were you there?
I was there probably 97, 98 or something like that till 2000, 2001. So the end of my teens I spent on Western and 77th.
Western and 77th. So where would you eat? You were a teenager, right?
I was. So one of the places next door, because we were right on Western.
Okay.
Was Quick and Split. So people from South Central know Quick and Split. Ice Cube named it in a song.
He did?
It's in one of his lyrics. He's talking about being, and I forgot which one, but he said, "Now I gotta rob Quick and Split." With the wicked shit, I like to dig a chick, but now I'm robbing Quick and Split. Like he's talking about being broke.
What is Quick and Split?
It was like, so if we're going to talk L.A., yeah. My generation growing up here, we didn't know anything was unique. I thought whatever's here must be elsewhere. And maybe right. That's because we see our city in movies all the time or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what I never thought about that. All the movies that you grow up watching where it takes place somewhere else, but they filmed it in L.A.
Yeah.
So maybe that makes you think that everywhere looks like here. Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Because I just did not know anything was unique.
Because like even the Blues Brothers, one of my favorite movies.
And that's a Chicago-ass movie.
It's a Chicago-ass movie, but the concert where John Candy wants or everybody wants to arrest him is the Palladium.
See?
And I didn't know for the longest.
The Palladium looms large.
Because Hollywood tricks you into thinking, oh, this is happening in Wisconsin. But then you go to the Palladium 100 times, and you're like, wait a second. The Blues Brothers was here. And so that's how you feel.
Many examples of that. The whole city is that.
It is.
The whole city is that.
The whole city is a backlot.
It is. And so...
So Quick and Split.
So I was going to say, L.A., that's what I meant. L.A. hamburger culture.
Ah.
I thought the way you can get a burger in L.A., mm-hmm. and Quick and Split's one of the many places that in South Central has many great L.A.-style burgers. So if you go, there are cities all over the country that think about themselves. So they will say, this sandwich, this is our shit. You go to Philly, they will tell you about their cheesesteak or their Chicago will tell you about its Italian beef sandwich.
Yeah.
We have our versions of that here. We never did that. We never named it.
You don't
it.
Brag about it.
I don't know why. We need to because we're losing it.
Well, the Beastie Boys flies flat fat burger when they're way out west.
When they went and recorded their album and were living in Atwater.
Yes.
And I trip on that. It's a great album too. But also they were like...
Build Communications, what you're talking about.
Yeah. Right? And remember, they were like dressing like L.A. dudes on the cover. The whole thing was L.A. And mm-hmm. they said it. They were open. They said L.A. inspired the sound of this album because it sounded West Coast. The whole thing felt like L.A. in the 90s. Because you're coming from the outside and it's the Muse, they like extra performed it.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, L.A. burgers, right? You got your Toms and your Tams and your Jims and you have all these places and you have your little one, you know, your Quick and Splits and your Master Burger and there used to be one in Pasadena, Wonder Burger and Super Burger, all these places.
Lucky Boy.
Lucky Boy. Lucky Boy is another one. Amy's, so many.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize they were lucky. No mm-hmm. pun intended.
Mm-hmm.
These are the best burgers.
They are.
So I spent 10 years doing work that had me travel around the country constantly. So for about a decade when I was living in New York, but I traveled the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I learned that you can't get those burgers anywhere else. And that didn't make sense to me. It's not that there aren't good burgers elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of places have good hamburgers.
Yeah.
But not like that.
You know, this also surprises me about the taco culture here. Because I was slow to the taco culture game. Because I was told as a black person, don't go to Boyle Heights. Don't go to East LA.
But you're from Chicago. Chicago has good tacos.
Not like these.
Okay. All right.
Not like these.
Right. Go but, on though. So you were told,
and so I was late.
You were told as a black person not to go to Boyle Heights because it's racist.
Because I'm not welcome.
Okay.
Not because that they're racist, but it was black on. I mean, this was
the
I
black got here brown, the black brown yeah. shit. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so they're like, stay in Inglewood. That's cool. And there's you can get some Mexican stuff in Inglewood, mm-hmm. but you don't have to go all the way over well, there.
South Central too.
So I never went to Boyle Heights until maybe 10 years ago. Uh huh. And it's just right down my street.
I know. It's the most centrally located community that no one goes
to. I mean, Sunset, like, you don't even have to work hard. And you're and
when
you're
people in are in downtown and they see the First Street Bridge or Sunset, it's like the maps of antiquity where there's dragons. You know? They just don't know they just don't go.
We don't.
And
we have to fix that.
Yes and no, because I love Boyle Heights and I am also...
You like just, it to be its own little
no,
thing?
No, it's just with the gentrification shit. It's one of the few places left that still feels like L.A.
But Boyle Heights, didn't they like bombard that art...
They fight back in Boyle Heights.
Yeah.
You know.
And Mariachi Square is always going to be Mariachi Square, right?
I mean, I don't know what's coming.
What about that bean and cheese burrito place?
Like, Island Bees?
Yeah. And the Japanese place across the street from it. Like, do you think that... Those are in danger? Am I being naive?
I don't know. I mean, the Japanese spot, Instagram has made that place really popular with the gentrifiers. So even if they don't otherwise come to Boyle Heights, first of all, they are coming to Boyle Heights. Let's not be naive. Mm-hmm. It's not at the same clip as other parts of LA, but it's coming. But when you walk by that Japanese spot, mm-hmm. that's run by the old lady who's running, and she's wonderful, by the way.
She's been there forever.
And she's great. There's always a huge line now. It's like Instagram-y people.
Yeah.
And Alan B's always does business. But to your point,
taco culture. By the way, I wasn't that blown away by that burrito. There's something wrong with me?
I like it, but it's not.
I like Snortown a lot better.
Going back to what you made a good connection. So,
okay.
The LA style burger.
Yeah.
Right? It's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
If we thought about ourselves the way other cities do, everybody would be like, that's an LA thing. How the Philly cheesesteak, they would say, because you can't get it anywhere else. And they serve it with the hot peppers on the side, the yellow peppers, the spread, right? Thousand Island, all that.
Mm-hmm.
It's unique to here.
Yeah.
And so all these different burger places here answer to that style of burger.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, a much less understood thing. You know how San Francisco has the Mission Burrito?
Love the Mission Burritos. El Farolito?
I'm not a fan. Not a fan of Mission Burritos.
Really?
But I'm glad you like them.
What's your problem with them?
I find it feels like you compartmentalized all these ingredients and wrapped it in a tortilla and nothing melds or blends and it's just meat and rice and beans and this and then some sauce and I get why people like them. It's a big meal. It's like a Subway sandwich.
It is big.
It's like a Subway sandwich, but for a burrito. I get why people like it. So conversely, there is an LA style burrito and not a lot of people know about this. Alan B's is an example of it. Burrito Express in Pasadena, that's another example.
One of Jonathan Gold's favorites.
And Alan B's and Burrito Express do the same thing. And it's an LA thing, as I was told, passed down knowledge, so maybe it's all bullshit. But what I was told is that this is the LA style burrito and that it's like the very fatty beans mm-hmm. with stewed meat mm-hmm. and some cheese. And that's it.
That's it.
And that's what Alan B's does. And they say that's an LA thing.
And maybe that's why I wasn't blown away.
Because you're eating stew with beans and cheese inside of a tortilla.
It was too subtle.
It's also very fatty. Mm-hmm. And it is subtle. It's not a meal in a tortilla the way a Mission style burrito is.
I would need two of these.
For sure. I mean, I would have assumed you do eat two of them. I'm not going
to
eat just one.
I went to school in Santa Barbara. And uh-huh. then I fell in love with burritos for real when I lived in San Francisco for a little while. So I was, I guessed, groomed, as they call it now, on the Mission Burrito.
Careful with the conspiracy is going to come to you now.
I hear you. Okay, so good. So I'll go back then and I'll give it another try. Because
I just didn't like it. I mean,
because I heard all the hype and I show up and I'm like, meh.
I'll still eat a Mission Burrito. I'm just saying I'm not a huge fan. But go back to Alan B's.
Okay.
Or to Burrito Express. Burrito Express is also funny because they named all their food is still 90s references. So they have one named after like Judge Lance Ito and one named after Ross Perot, and they've just never updated it. So I love that about Burrito Express. But go to Allenby. Yeah, it's great. But
so, okay. What's the burger place in Chesterfield Square called?
It's not there anymore.
No.
Quick and Split.
Quick and Split is
they
gone?
They moved. They're somewhere. Because I one time made a remark online about missing Quick and Split, and then Quick and Split's account was like, we're still around.
Hey.
So they're somewhere. So yeah, Western and 77th.
Okay.
Late 90s, early 2000s was a very very big Belizean community, big Garifuna community, a lot of music.
Were you pressured to be in a gang?
I moved around so much.
Mm-hmm.
I moved around a lot. I'm not going to say I was never pressured, but I wasn't deep in any one neighborhood enough to have the generational pressure that some places did.
So what would you do when people would say, where are you from? Who do you repping?
I said, who you bang with? Whatever kid said back then.
Which is what?
I don't bang.
That's all it takes?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean,
well, that's good.
I think it was that general thing of like, don't go looking for trouble.
Yep.
Don't act like you want trouble. Don't dress like you want trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I never got hit up. I don't know of any boy of my generation that didn't get hit up all the time back then. It was
hit up meaning what?
Where are you from? Somebody say, where are you from? You say, I don't bang. And they'd be like, well, I'm so-and-so from so-and-so. And then he'd say, cool. Yeah. All right.
And then
you would hope that it would end there.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that.
You know, I feel like the movies made it out. Well, sometimes shit was senseless. I mean, I knew people who got killed. I knew young people who got killed for no reason. Mm-hmm. I did. There were some really tragic, messed up things that happened. But by and large, it wasn't as craven as people made it out to be. I mean, people were banging on each other and like, it was, that's my enemy. We're fighting our enemy. So if you're not my enemy, we don't have a problem. But it doesn't mean that there weren't situations. And it just depended on who and what, you know. So where we lived back then, that neighborhood was 8 Tray. And it was 18th Street, you know. And I never had a problem with anybody. I mean, a lot went down. I mean, you know, a lot of parties got shot up.
Oh, really?
A lot of parties got shot up.
You'd be in a party and you'd hear gunfire.
Somebody would start shooting at somebody at a party. But that wasn't just in South Central. That happened everywhere all the time.
Pasadena?
Pasadena had a very active gang culture in the 80s and 90s. Just depended on where. You know, Pasadena's interesting. Because Pasadena has a lot of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has a lot of poverty. Mm-hmm. I don't know about today's Pasadena. It's pretty gentrified.
Yeah.
But
I've seen some pockets.
Pasadena had lots of poverty, but it was able to sell itself as a wealthy city.
Let's wrap up with kids and family.
Okay.
Since you're a father of, I think, 36 people right now. I like to talk to parents about L.A. because one of the things that some people say when they are considering L.A. to move to with kids is there's no way I'd raise kids in LA. So you grew up in LA.
Yes.
You're raising children in LA. I grew up in the suburbs of Illinois, as safe as can be. Bicycle, you didn't even lock your bicycle.
So you grew up in the suburbs of Chicago?
The yes.
Okay.
Like Ferris Bueller's Day Off type of place, you know?
Like the Macaulay Culkin, the Matt?
Very much so.
What was that director's name?
John Hughes.
Did you grow up in one of those, the McAllister household?
We were not that rich, but we had friends who did.
Okay.
For sure.
So Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Ferris
John
Bueller.
John Hughes, Chicago.
I mean, those high schools were near me.
Got you.
And so
we'll have to talk about that sometime. I've always been fascinated about what that was.
And likewise, I was fascinated about city life.
Makes sense.
And so I feel like if I had to do it over again and I was a young person, I would rather raise kids in an urban place like L.A. than in the suburbs.
But the thing about L.A. that's strange is L.A.'s urban and suburban at the same time.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
South Central is suburban as hell.
That's right. But you could hop on a bus and go to the beach.
It's just one of these places that's just, I mean, there's nowhere like L.A. It's such a strangely, badly, oddly designed place. And so we're neither urban or suburban.
Right.
So as far as raising kids, I mean, and that brings a specific kind of diversity going just to complete the thought about Pasadena, where mm-hmm. where you have areas like that, like Long Beach is like that. Pasadena to me and Long Beach are very similar, where you have upscale next to impoverished, both extremely ethnically diverse areas. So they're both areas that carry multiple stereotypes. Mm-hmm. So depending on who you talk to, people will think Pasadena is very wealthy. Other people will be like, no, it's a gang ridden, very violent, lots of shootings. And they say the same about like Long Beach.
Yeah.
And and that's all. But so tell me what you were going to ask about the raising of kids.
I'm asking you. What would you say to parents who are unsure about raising kids in LA?
I mean, if you're a parent who is afraid to raise their kid in a place is likely projecting a lot of their own BS onto what they think that place is or isn't. You know, the post-gentrified LA is a difficult place to raise kids, but not because of what they might be afraid of. It's because of them. You have whole areas where instead of chartering the school, they chartered the whole neighborhood. They chartered the zip code. Mm. And, you know, I have raised kids here. When I was young, I would have imagined that I was going to raise kids around the people I knew. And that's not what happened. I ended up raising my kids around a lot of transplants, a lot of very well-off people who I didn't decide to live near them. They decided to live near me. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, that at times was very alienating and very frustrating and very disorienting for me. LA has, you know, a lot of charter schools now, district charter schools, public schools. It's kind of a mess. There's some good ones. There's some not good ones. I feel sad because gentrification has actually lessened our diversity. So the LA that Jonathan Gold always celebrated, it's still here, but not the way it used to be. So I feel like kids here, it's still a big diverse city. But they're not getting the diversity they used to get is what I'm finding. And all of my kids are around a lot more wealthy people than I imagined they would. And I don't live in a wealthy area at all. So that's, I feel encroached upon all the time. I also think that the thing that was the same then that's the same now is the lack of public infrastructure here makes it hard for kids. So when I was young, there was a lack of public infrastructure, but there was also inner city vacancies, which meant there was community spaces everywhere. And there were storefront activist spaces. There was art spaces. There was free music in the park all the time. There was off the grid shows happening all the time in hotel basements or in abandoned buildings in downtown. So you could find lots of ways to have fun without money. Mm. In today's LA, it's not like that. You have to have money. It's much harder. It's not that it doesn't exist, right? The LA of like Van Halen playing backyard concerts in Pasadena, that's much less, but it's still some of it exists. People still do shows at people's, but it's a lot harder. Who has a house now? Mm-hmm. Like it used to always be house parties and dance halls, right? The Belizean community, you go down to the Prince Hall Auditorium down there on Fig in 91st, I think. There was always like Belizean shows there, Caribbean shows, Central American shows. Up here in, you know, Silver Lake, Echo Park, there was tons of venues and they were cheap and accessible and a lot of times free. And then there was like just free shows all the time. And so with like world-class bands too, you know, mm-hmm. or bands right before they got famous. Mm-hmm. And the backyard concert circuit constantly.
I talk about the Sunset Junction Street Fair that mm-hmm. used to be free. Then it slowly...
And then
people.
Even prior to Sunset Junction, that same neighborhood, people lived there. Regular people lived in Echo Park and Silver Lake. And those houses, there was parties at those houses. You know the band Chicano Batman?
Yeah.
So Eddie from Chicano. You should interview him sometime. He always talks about, he was saying, so we co-founded along with a bunch of other people, like a youth radio collective 20 years ago, Soul Rebel Radio on KPFK. And this was obviously before Chicano Batman, before all these things. But when they were first getting going, they would play backyard shows in Echo Park and Silver Lake and Highland Park and those places. And I remember him telling me that when he first started to gig, when they first started to get kind of famous as a band, that he couldn't keep his mouth shut because it was the same areas but different. Like when they played Sunset Junction, he would blurt out like, well, we used to be able to play backyards here. And I think that's where I think about my kids, because there is some of that, but it's so much less accessible than it used to be. Me cutting out an ad in the back of the LA Weekly to go to a concert couldn't happen now. So the hyper-commodification of space, the hyper-commodification of culture has been very alienating, but the youth come up with their own shit. And so whatever young people are going to be creating now, because they also have platforms, you inherit social media, that's your own platform now, you can do whatever you want. They're doing stuff and they're going to be doing stuff. And I think that the fears, right? I grew up in drug war era LA. It was violent. It was. It actually, like, really was. But again, still not the way the movies try to make you feel about stuff. And that was the era that a whole aesthetic for Los Angeles came out of the era of my childhood. That's when Cops came out. That's when, like, the Michael Mann movies with the freeway chases. I didn't know that helicopters weren't normal. The constant helicopters over our head, which is actually so awful. I didn't realize that doesn't exist everywhere. I thought every city must have that. No, I was shocked to learn that most cities don't deal with that. But that whole aesthetic of LA as the dystopic, hyper-violent, Blade Runner 80s, you know, was such an aesthetic. That I still think is ingrained into a lot of the, because I'm the generation that's the parents now. So they imagine all these things. The truth is, the difficulty for LA, and this is really what comes down to for every social issue that people are struggling with right now, is that people cannot afford to live here anymore. It's driving people into the street. It's driving people away. The homelessness issue has everything to do with cost of living and nothing to do with drugs. That's a fucking lie. Not everybody does drugs, but everybody who does them whether they're in a house or not in a house. And it's a cost of living issue. So when you lose all of those things and you make a place so difficult to live in, that's what they should be concerned about. What kind of economically polemic environment are you raising your kids in, and what does that mean? And the last thing I'll say is that when you come from an orientation, and I say this a lot, if you come from an orientation of suburban exclusivity, that's how you were raised, but you want to be in the city. If you're not putting that shit in check, then you're bringing that suburban exclusivity into an urban space, and that now you're making it segregationist. You're making it violent. You're making it impossible, actually. And we saw that. We see it every time. The 6th Street Bridge gets rebuilt, and people start complaining right away. It's like, what do you think public space is? It's public.
They complain because the lowrider showed up.
They complain because they hate sharing shit. Because they come from a mentality orientation of suburban exclusivity, and they think everything's supposed to be for them. Gentrification is the idea of a curated urban theme park versus an environment you develop a relationship with. The mentality of suburban exclusivity has its roots in getting away from the people you don't want to be around.
Intentionally moving away from urban.
Intentionally moving away from the underclass. Mm. It's often very racist. It's certainly 100% is very classist. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it manifests that way now because there's been a reversal. So now the suburbs are where a lot of working class people live. But
yeah.
The orientation is of exclusivity. Urban space is designed to be shared space. And that's what makes it vibrant. That's what makes the children of the suburban folks want to be there because they feel alienated. But then you come here and you haven't processed honestly with yourself. So then you come and you start complaining or not wanting to share. So you see people engaging with public space in a way you don't want to. And now it's a problem. And this is why I have mistrust for things that on the surface make sense. Yeah, on the surface, we want a more walkable city. Right. But then it becomes bike lanes. And the amount of projection that goes into bike lanes is if we're all just going to be in a fucking bike lane like a Richard Scarry book. It's absurd because people have been forced to be car dependent here. And those families got to get their kids to school and they got to go to work. And you want to make that hard? It's so Reaganite. Let's make it harder for other people to make it easier for ourselves rather than what we should be saying, which is go ahead, invest in all that infrastructure, build it, and then we can talk. Let me see it first. A bike lane is a symbol. We're not all going to use bike lanes, and I love riding a bike. It's a symbol for what you're projecting onto urban space, and that's not meant to be an indictment. A lot of really good people who earnestly want more of that, but I'm telling you, so much of that ends up contained in it. And so going to for the last, you know, to close here, if you're going to raise your kids in LA, really what we're saying is if what it sounds like is like if you're not from here and you come here, don't miss out on what the city, you know, was and is, and try not to project everything onto it. And I think that's universal. If I'm moving to some other city, if you're from Chicago, if I move to Chicago, I'd like to think that I would be excited to get to know Chicago and get into like Chicago shit.
That's right.
Rather than imposing my insecurities onto it. So I ideally would like for people to stop doing that to LA too, which, you know, it's a futile request in some ways, but it's also because, like I said, we didn't brand our own culture here. We didn't think about it a lot, and now it's being branded. But in my fear is that it becomes the museum exhibit. Like, now there's Nipsey murals everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and R.I.P. to Nipsey, and he was trying to do a good thing actually, and that's not the point. The point is then people taking those symbols and making them brands. So the whole lowrider aesthetic or old English font or whatever the fuck people imagine is LA, or the old school pre-old English, the old school graph fonts that you see, that's cool. It's actually cool when a place can come to terms and embrace its own brand, but to a point.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it also becomes commodified, or it becomes just a museum exhibit, which means it's extinct. York Boulevard is the manifestation of my greatest fear of what could happen to Los Angeles. My fear is everything turning into York. So we can end there. If you're raising your kids here.
R.I.P. You know, Highland Park.
Oh, man. Yeah, you know, no disrespect.
Lex, what a pleasure to meet you.
Likewise.
I want people to follow you on Twitter. Do you want to give out your Twitter account? Or would you rather not?
It doesn't matter.
Great. What's your Twitter account?
It's Lex Stepp. It's LexStepp.
Lex Drip, how do you say your last name?
Stepling.
Stepling.
Yeah.
Have you met other Stepplings?
The only ones that I've ever come across are somehow related to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on Twitter.
Yeah.
Do you want them to follow you anywhere else? Is there anything you want to hype?
No.
We can't even go to your burger place anymore.
Try to enjoy good LA burgers. They are everywhere. Find those types of places. Okay. The gyms and the Tams and the Tom's and all those kinds of places. Go have a good LA burger, get extra yellow peppers, enjoy it. Try to enjoy LA for what it is. Try to learn more about it. Try not to impose your own ideas of what a city's supposed to be, because LA doesn't make any sense. So try to enjoy that, because if you can, you know how they say with New York, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. It's not true. New York gives you a lot. New York offers you a lot. LA is the real place where it kind of makes or breaks a person, because there's a lot about this place that's nonsensical and difficult and chaotic. But out of that comes a lot of special things. And I know everybody complains about gentrification, but let me add my complaints to that, because there's cultural things here that are important, including about our food, including about how people used to get to enjoy the arts, and public space was never done well here. So when there is public space, don't project all your BS onto it. And if you want to raise your kids here, raise them sensibly like you'd raise them anywhere else, and try not to create too much exclusivity. Try not to redline your children's try not to force other people to be redlined by you wanting to curate your child's experience. And with everything, right, gentrification brings a certain level of like economic oppression. And, you know, everybody here deserves to be able to live here and raise their families.
and LA is becoming a nearly impossible place to raise a family. And it all goes back to cost of living. And everybody knows that, but the discourse disintegrates and it could be better. And I'm going to stop there. So we said we weren't going to talk any politics.
No, no, no. the thing that breaks my heart the most about the cost of living here in LA, especially with families, we might have the greatest baseball player of all time.
Yeah.
And how are you going to take four kids to that game?
I'm not.
Right. And that's messed up.
And my kids like going to baseball games.
And the thing about baseball, especially with dads, no disrespect for moms, but especially sports with dads is a unique thing. And that's usually how we get into sports. Mm-hmm. And if you can't take a family of six to the bleachers of Dodger Stadium, which used to cost $5, anybody could go. And you'd get in a fight with somebody. But that was the thing. That was the whole thing. We can't, I don't think kids are going to be able to do that now. And dads aren't going to be able to teach them about Shohei, the greatest player of all. Yeah. Isn't that heartbreaking?
I mean, I don't know what's coming because, you know, I grew up with Vin Scully and Chick Hearn.
Right.
And then you could go to games, right? Laker games at the Forum were accessible somewhat. Mm-hmm. And certainly Dodger Stadium was very accessible. Dodger Stadium was very affordable.
The best.
And now it's not. And I don't know what that means. And if not for my love of following baseball, I would be pretty disenchanted at this point.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I don't know what's going to happen. But yeah, the pastoral experience of taking a family to a baseball game is no longer there. And the corporate interests behind baseball keep trying to make it like football or like basketball, like this event thing. And that's not what baseball is anyway. So no. Baseball is going to have to experience its own dissonance. But the truth is it's such an amazing sport that it's always going to have lots of fans because baseball is not just a sport. It's a thing you kind of study.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So yeah, man, this has been cool. Let's do it again.
Are the Dodgers going to win the World Series this year?
Yes.
Are the Clippers going to win the NBA championship?
Never.
Never.
They need to go back to San Diego.
Oh, Lex, thank you so much.
Why are they
much?
Called the Clippers? That's a San Diego thing. It's like the Utah Jazz. It's
wait, they're not barbers? They're not giving each other fades in the locker room?
That would be funny. But if you can name your team after a specific boat. Well,
what are the Lakers named after?
Lakes.
Not Echo Park Lake, sir.
No, but at least there is an Echo Park Lake. There's not a Clipper ship in Echo Park.
How great was Lex? You know who we'd eat burgers with in the hood? Our Patreons. When you stoke us, you're saying, Tony, here's some box seats to see Ohtani play. Take a date. So shout out to our Patreons, Nancy Rahmaman, Sean Atlow, Matt Mills, Sean Wallace, Greg and Molly, Jamie Taylor, Mark Johnson, Kira Ann, Barney Greinke, Ben Welsh, Jen Adams, Trevor Wilson, Bree Wild, Dougie Gyro, Christina Up North, Robin Carey, Adam Shorn, Ben from Down Under, Chris from the ATX, Gregor, and Phil. To be a Patreon, just go to patreon.com/hereinLA and give until it hurts you. Want to support us, but you're not exactly, how you say, liquid right now? You can still help. Post your favorite episode on your Facebook. Start with this one. Tweet a link on your Twitter or on your Threads or on your Truth Social. Put it on your live journal for all I care. I've been known to put it on my LinkedIn. But whatever you do, tell your friends. Tell them how Here in LA is spelled, and it's on Apple Podcasts and Google and even on this YouTube. Here in LA is produced by myself, Tony Pierce. Music supervision by Jordan Katz. Songs by Orgone and Jordan Katz. Special thanks to Cindy for creating the logo, Jen for inspiring this, and Native Angelinos everywhere who put up with transplants like me. Thank you, Patriots. And I'll see you at Mazda.